On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we talk about Roman Anthony's extension, 8 years, $130 million, with the opportunity to earn even more than that. How did this 21-year-old end up with this massive contract extension? We dig into it. We also talk about Andrew Vaughn's incredible run with the Brewers since arriving from the lowly White Sox. What has happened there? Why is he hitting so well? Will it sustain? We go around the league, talk about Jen Powell making Major League history as the first woman to umpire a Major League game. And then, of course, it is Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello, and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that loves the dog days of summer, because it's when the real ball knowers get to shine. I'm Jake Mintz. That is Jordan Schusterman, and it's so nice for them to name the days after us. Couple of dogs.
It us. We some dogs, as they say. It's good to see you, Jake. Happy Friday. I'm so happy to be back after my brief respite from podcasting. I normally listen to the pods that I skip pretty quickly, but I have not done so. So I'm just going to have to take your word for it that the great Foolish Baseball did just okay in my place.
It was like a 105 OPS plus pod, I'd say, which is, you know, it's fine.
Hey, I can think of a lot of teams that would love to have a 105 OPS plus pod or hitter or however you want to call it. But I'm happy to be back here for this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast. We have plenty to get to, so let's get into it. The big news, Roman Anthony is very rich. It's our opener.
The Boston Red Sox, the team of 2025, no matter how this season pans out, have made news once again by extending an extension to Roman Anthony. 8 years, $130 million is the base value of this contract. If everything goes wrong, Roman Anthony will still get $130 million, which is a good thing. There is a team option for $30 million in 2034. He can max out at $230 million with escalators, which always makes it sound like the Red Sox are like, they'll pay for escalators in his house. Maybe that's what this is. It's not contract escalators. It's actual escalators.
I mean, if these get picked up, like, he will be able to afford that. I don't know if residential escalators exist. I've consumed a lot of, like, super fancy home YouTube content. I don't know if I've ever seen an escalator in a house. I've definitely seen elevators. Like, that's pretty standard for the super rich folks. But an escalator is so preposterous and silly to have in your own home that now I kind of hope that Roman Anthony wins MVP 8 times and maxes out this contract and puts escalators in his Boston. I don't know there are some rich neighborhoods in and around Boston. I don't know what the richest one is that is most likely to have escalators. I guess maybe, you know, out on Cape Cod or
email
something.
Email us. Let us know.
But yeah. I'm sure we have some Boston area listeners that could let us know where would you most likely find an escalator in a home. All right, let's talk about the baseball player, Jake, because Roman Anthony, who was born on May 13th, 2004, now has generational wealth. Congratulations to Roman Anthony. You earned it, big
for
guy.
A new generation.
You have arrived. You showed up to the big leagues as the top prospect in baseball for a team that has been hyping you up for a couple years now. And through your first 47 games, you have reached base almost 40% of the time. And that is the kind of thing that gets you paid. Obviously, we have talked about this player a good amount over the course of this season leading up to his debut, after his debut, now that he has settled in as clearly one of their top players. Leadoff hitter, wasn't necessarily expecting that. But as I just mentioned, he does get on base, and that is a good thing to do if you are a leadoff hitter. Only 2 home runs so far in the big leagues through 47 games. But what you are seeing as a hitter, the maturity, the comfort, the impact. I know it's not home runs yet, but how hard he is hitting the ball. All of these are the signs that make a organization want to give a 21-year-old $130 million.
And once he goes through puberty, he's going to start elevating the baseball. You got to think. I thought what Anthony said yesterday was pretty interesting to me. These types of deals often get breached during spring training. These contracts for kind of, you know, earlier in their career players. We've seen this with Corbin Carroll, right, who came up at the end of a season, did spring training, got the extension kind of in his first full season. Roman Anthony said, like, look, I didn't want to sign anything before I got here. I wanted to experience what it was like to be a big leaguer. I wanted to experience what it was like to be a big leaguer here in Boston. And, you know, 150 days of that later, he's like, yes, this is it. This is what I want my life to be for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. And again, I think contracts like this, and by the way, you know, the Red Sox have now signed a bunch of these extensions. Obviously, the Devers one was a very different category because he was farther into his career and he was more established. And that was really trying to give him something that was going to keep him face of the franchise for a long time. We know how that turned out. But they've also done it with these younger players. They gave it to Christian Campbell. We know that one is not looking awesome so far. Now, that was half the price. I mean, that was an 8-year, $60 million for a player that was not quite as proven. But Sidán Rafaela and Brian Bello, two other young players that they've invested in. Now, again, not to this degree, but clearly Boston, this has been an avenue. And Garrett Crochet, another big one. Again, that's a little bit of a different category. But this is an example where Boston is reminding us, oh, yeah, we got a lot of money. And when we do want to spend it, we can spend it. And this is, especially when we're talking about a hitter like Roman Anthony, a guy who's coming up this young. And the reason it's so important for someone like him is because, not that, you know, his free agency is around the corner, but his free agency at potentially his age, which would be 26, 27, is where you start getting into the outrageous sums of money. And so if you believe in the player and you think, like, yes, like, this dude is going to be good. We believe in him more than $100 million and to get his back half of his 20s as well. And if you're Roman Anthony, you could say, I can secure $130 million, if not more, and I still get to become a free agent if I want at a normal time to become a free agent, which is 30, 31. It is the kind of deal that you can understand for both sides, even though you can also understand people being like, what a steal this is. And like, yes, this is still team friendly. It's hard to imagine this being a bad situation, bad contract for Boston. But you can't blame the 21-year-old kid for taking $130 million guaranteed.
No, you can't. And I do think it's important to understand the context here, right? This is life-changing money, and there is real risk. Think of all the prospects who did not take the deal, who did not turn into anything. I saw a tweet from friend of the show, John Becker, like Jared Kelnick, right? There were extension talks. He wanted to bet on himself and reach free agency and go on the open market. Guess what he's going to get on the open market now? A one-way ticket to the KBO. All right? Not every player is Juan Soto. You know, not every player is going to get that enormous. Most are not. In fact, all of the players are not Juan Soto except for Juan Soto. Now, on the flip side, you have deals like the Ronald Acuña deal that look like an enormous bargain where you're getting the player young, like you're getting them under contract young so that you don't have to pay, for instance, Devers type prices, Vlad Jr. type prices. And that's what happens if you don't act, right? If you're Boston, you like, yes, the Blue Jays in the end paid a very high worthy price for Guerrero to get a statue outside the stadium in 15 years. They've been playing great, but they had to spend a number beyond what they may have had to spend if they had been more proactive. So kudos. I'm going to say kudos to Craig Breslow for doing the GMing.
Yeah. And obviously ownership's a big part of this too. And I think that they've, you know, reading the people who cover this team regularly and talk about this team regularly, like, obviously, there's a lot of context with this franchise and the contracts that they have signed and haven't signed and all the Mookie of it all and Xander and whatever. And I think they've said, like, yeah, with Mookie, by the time we were negotiating extension with him, it was far too late. And so had they gone to Mookie Betts, you know, a year or two into his career, maybe you get something like that done. And I think that this is just almost clearly a trend in baseball.
Yeah. You almost certainly get it done. It shows an investment in the player at a stage when they're not a finished product. Because if you're in a young player, free agency is more than a half decade away. Like, it's hard to comprehend worth waiting for that. Like, you're a different human being when that arrives. And so I'm never going to fault a player for taking this type of money when it's on the table.
Yeah, and I think too, for Anthony in particular, I mean, like, let's just get back to on the field. I mean, you're seeing what you want to see, right? I think that what he showed in the minor leagues and just already the degree to which he does not look overwhelmed and still clearly not even close to a finished product. He's still striking out a bunch, hitting it on the ground a bunch. But, I mean, he's showing elite, bat speed, exit velocities, like hard hit rates already. I mean, it has not taken long for him to start to demonstrate that. And like we said, it hasn't necessarily totally manifested in the production yet, but those are the kinds of underlying things that we've seen at every level. And obviously for Boston to, I have to imagine if you're that player, yes, there's a level of, oh no, I believe in myself even more. I can make $300, $400, $500, $600 million when I finally get to free agency. To know how much the organization believes in you to that degree has to also feel really good. And I think that no matter what, and you mentioned the Acuna one, in some ways, yes, it still looks cheap because when he's been on the field, he's been unbelievable. And it also is a reminder of the risks of injuries for any players, not just hitter, not just pitchers. And so, of course, the injury luck for Acuna is about as bad as it gets. And you hope you wouldn't wish that on anybody. And I think for Roman Anthony, who, whether he's left field or center fielder, who knows, but you're betting on the bat. And I mean, it's as good as it gets. And it's obviously, it comes at a pretty good time for Boston. Add it to the what if Netflix doc in 2025, but not just all the drama of this season, but also they're certainly playing quite well right now, coming off a deadline where the fans were not happy. And Breslow, man, like, he's just going back and forth, making us wonder, like, man, is he really good at this? Does he not know what he's doing? Like, I don't know. I mean, when we're talking about contract extensions like this, you just know that ownership is a huge part of it, and you have to give them credit too. But obviously, Breslow is still the one negotiating and coming up with the structure, and so you got to give him credit for executing, because it's this is not a small achievement to get Roman Anthony secured for the long haul.
You couldn't pay me $130 million to live in Boston, a city that I jokingly hate. No, you could. Craig Breslow, I was going to say.
You would. Okay, all right. So Breslow, just keep that in mind. Jake will sign for $130 million.
Anyway, nothing against the team, so, just the city.
We're going to get a bunch more emails about that. Thank you. Every time Jake does this, we get Boston emails like, what's the deal? Anyway, Red Sox have won 8 of their last 10. They're still 4 games behind Toronto. But going on, I believe, a little bit of a West Coast swing. I know they got San Diego. San Diego and Houston. Okay, that's an interesting back-to-back series for them. But Roman Anthony will be at the center of it. He is now officially a Red Sox main character, and he earned it. He earned it. All right, we are going to take a quick break. When we return, we're going to talk about another super-duper star. Will he get an $100 million extension? Andrew Vaughn? What? We'll be right back on Baseball Barbie.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. One last quick nugget on Roman Anthony. He is already the MLB all-time leader in wins above replacement by a Roman. He is ahead of the other Romans, Roman Quinn, Roman Mendez, Roman Mejias, Roman Colon, and I believe he's above Alex Liddy as well.
Alex Liddy, 3-time futures game starter. Alex Liddy, put some respect on his name, a Mariners icon and a great joke.
He's also not from Rome. Not from Rome,
but
he's close, from San Remo.
Closer to Rome, technically. Anyway, wow, Roman Mendez. Haven't thought about him in a minute. All right, Jake. The Milwaukee Brewers became the first team to get to 70 wins. There are so many things we could talk about with the Brewers, but there is one thing and one hitter that we absolutely need to talk about.
Andrew Clayton Vaughn, the blonde-haired, dark, beady-eyed, bizarrely shaped first baseman who was the number 3 overall pick in the 2019 draft by the Chicago White Sox behind Adley Rutschman and Bobby Witt Jr. He matriculates up to the big leagues in 2021. And from 2021 until 2024, he is unbelievably mediocre. He is not your traditional bust because he is playable. He is a 101 OPS plus hitter, 1% above league average. The White Sox try and shoehorn him into an outfield corner, which goes disastrously. But he's fine. He's a fine hitter. He is not the reason that they are bad. And he is not helping them become good. He is effectively a houseplant. And then this year in 2025, the wheels come off. From opening day until May 23rd, Andrew Vaughn was the single least valuable player in all of baseball. Negative 1.4 wins above replacement, according to Fangraphs. He was slashing, this is just really horrible stuff, Jordan. He was slashing 189, 218, 314 across 193 plate appearances. And the White Sox say that's not good enough. So they demote him to AAA at the age of 27. 2 weeks later, they ship him off to Milwaukee in exchange for Aaron Civale, who they, I guess, wanted to trade at the deadline. And then I guess they didn't for some reason. Vaughn joins the Brewers, goes up to the big leagues on July 7th after an injury to Rhys Hoskins. And since July 7th, Andrew Vaughn has been the single best hitter in the National League. Literally, he leads the National League in OPS since he became a Milwaukee Brewer. It is a remarkable turnaround, granted, in somewhat of a small sample, just 22 games. But there are some signs here that this is pretty darn real.
Yeah, and I want to get to how real it is and some of those adjustments that I know you've dug into. But I want to look backwards a little bit more because I think you hit on a couple very key points along the way that help tell this story and help me, I think, all of us appreciate the fact that he now has a, 1100 OPS with the Brewers, who are unstoppable no matter who they put in the lineup. So the first thing is the obvious one that you started with, right? Third overall pick. And I think it's important to remember that while he was not as hyped as Adley Rutschman or Bobby Witt Jr., as the guy drafted right behind them, I mean, he was one of the more accomplished college hitters that we've seen, three years of excelling at Cal, including a sophomore year that is still one of the most ridiculous statistical seasons that we've seen. This is also a little bit before offense really goes nuts in college baseball, which was a little bit, the last five or so years where the power numbers just spike like crazy across the country. But his sophomore year, which is really what set him up to be this top pick going into his junior year in 2019, 1350 OPS, 44 walks, 18 strikeouts, 23 homers at Cal. I mean, it was ridiculous. Now, his junior year wasn't quite as good, but it was still very similar. But this was a 5'10" right-handed first baseman. That is not someone you normally would want to see teams jumping all over themselves to draft at the top, and yet that's what Andrew Vaughn had kind of become. So when he gets to the big leagues really quickly and is like fine, you're like, okay, but there's got to be more, right? And really, it was the ultimate just plateau. Like, all right, this is what he is. But what happened last year, or I should say this year,
can I hop in on the draft last year?
Oh yeah, sure. Go ahead. Then before I get closer to this time, yeah, go ahead.
He was the single highest drafted right-handed first baseman ever. Okay. tying a gentleman named Dave McCarty, who was the third overall pick in 1991. All right. The single highest right-handed first baseman ever taken. And I think that that is an important part of the story because it just underscores how much confidence there was that he was a difference-making hitter, that he was going to move the needle, that he was going to rake. Because that profile is just so unappealing to teams. And even though the White Sox were not exactly a genius organization at the time, Vaughn was a consensus top talent. Like when the White Sox took Vaughn third overall, no one was like, what are they doing? This is nuts. Right. And so for them to buck that trend and for the industry to buck that trend to such a significant degree, it's like the belief was really, really large that this guy was going to hit. And so when he was just like, fine, it was very odd.
Yeah, especially when, I mean, a huge sample, right? I mean, he spends most of 2021 in the big leagues, all of 2022, all of 2023. And then what's also important is that last year to start the season, he was horrible. Not quite as horrible as this year, but last year he was also horrible. And then in June, he had the best month of his career until this ridiculous stretch. You look at his June of last season, it was like, oh my God, here we go. Has Andrew Vaughn finally figured it out? Obviously, it was going on amidst the worst team in the history of the sport, so no one really cared. But it was like, All right, maybe we're getting something. But then this year, he starts off, as we sang, as the worst player in baseball for 2 months. But the other funny data point, and just like along the way, is when you think, when people say, oh, the Brewers got him and he immediately was awesome. No. The Brewers got him and sent him to AAA because it's not like he was hitting in AAA with the Chicago, and he wasn't even really hitting in AAA with Milwaukee until Rhys Hoskins got hurt, right? This was not just earn show his way up and start raking. No, not the opposite, right? It required an injury to give him that opening, and not to mention the fact that the only reason that they got him from the White Sox is because Aaron Civale wanted to continue being a starter. Remember that story for 3 days? It was like, Aaron Civale.
Trade
like,
me.
Demands to stay in the rotation. They're like, okay, we'll trade you. And I guess at that point, the White Sox are like, whatever. Like, we're done with this Andrew Vaughn thing. We're already turning the page on so many parts of this era of White Sox baseball. Sure, Brewers, take Andrew Vaughn. We can't fix this guy. And then fast forward to now, let's talk about the fixes and what he's doing. Yeah. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. He's hitting .377, .444, and .701. He's already got 7 homers, which is, of course, more homers than he hit with the White Sox in, half as many games. And on one hand, you're like, well, yeah, finally, he's 27. He's a former third pick. We've seen him show power at times, and it just hasn't come together as a complete offensive package. But what are you seeing as far as things that we can actually believe in? Because him being the best hitter in the National League the rest of the way, I'll probably take the under. No. But is this someone that we should take seriously as a middle-of-the-order presence for Milwaukee as they head into the postseason?
Kind of. I think this has all of the indicators of a meaningful change. The most interesting thing to me is that there's been a distinct change in philosophy around him, and he's being told to emphasize different things. When he got sent down by the White Sox, Chris Getz, the Sox GM, talked to reporters and said, at this point, we can't just rely on expected numbers. The level of production that we need to see out of him in that position needs to be better. There's some physical adjustments that can be made. We're going to work on that. We're going to dive into that, okay? When I was around the Brewers last week and people were asking about Andrew Vaughn, their skipper, Pat Murphy, was very adamant that the Brewers were not making significant mechanical changes to Andrew Vaughn. He said, quote, he's found the freedom to compete to bring out his best self. And part of that best self is, in order to be effective, I have to demand what the pitcher does. I have to be the one that dictates what I swing at, his readiness pitch to pitch, and his ability to lay off some things. It's been very good. Right. So that to me sounds like the Brewers sat him down and said, stop chasing. And he said, okay. And obviously it's not that simple, but the Brewers as an organization really do emphasize swing decisions. And by laying off pitches outside the zone, it's putting Vaughn in better counts more often and allowing him to get his A swing off on balls in the zone. Now he's also facing more lefties than he was. He's being used in a more advantageous way. It's not a full platoon, and now he's essentially playing every day, right? But I think that that is a very interesting switch. And remember, like, if you're on the White Sox from 2022 to 2023, 2024, I understand that maybe you're not getting the most thorough instruction or you're not the most motivated to change your approach. That's a really difficult environment to succeed in. And for him to go from, I would say, what, like a bottom three environment to what appears to be a top three environment in terms of instruction and getting the most out of players we've never heard of. One evaluator described it to me, Jordan, as like a culture shock in a good way, right? Yeah. Where he's like, oh my God, there's all these resources that are available to me and they believe in me and they're letting me, they're giving me run. Like that in and of itself is not going to fix a player. He also is swinging a little bit harder. I think that is worth noting. But like, do I think he's an all-star? No. Do I think he's a legitimate above average first baseman moving forward for like the next 3 years? Maybe. Yeah. Like I think so.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that because that's the other kind of wild part about this is he's under team control for two more seasons, right? This is not a minor league free agent that signed in the offseason after his time had run out. Like, they still got him. If he does become that above it, which by the way would be huge for how much money he's making or not making, I should be saying, compared to what of course they've been paying Rhys Hoskins the last couple of years, which we love Rhys. We know he's been dealing with injuries and he was also having a fantastic season before he went down. But the point is that like what a find that would be to kind of have there. I think the only other thing I would add off of, because I think you touched on both some of the soft factors, the context, the environment, and also maybe some of the actual tangible changes to the approach. I think it is important to just remember that, right, there was a base of like power skills that have basically been there the whole time. And so that is where you can make serious gains when you do start swinging at the right pitches, when you are in hitters' counts. He has generally hit the ball pretty hard his whole career. And so now that he's just in more position to do that, as you said, it's not that shocking that there is a level above that he has been able to unlock. Now, to this degree, sure, there is an element to it that is pretty amazing how quickly they've gotten those results. But there have been other breakouts where players have gone from just like downright terrible to good that have been more shocking than this, I guess is maybe one way to say it. So doesn't mean we take credit away from Andrew Vaughn or take credit away from the Brewers. But there is part of it where it's like, there was some of this that was in there. And now it's just come out at the best possible time for a team that can seemingly do no wrong. And so that's why we needed to talk about it.
If you're ranking out of nowhere breakouts, the Brewers getting the most out of the third overall pick who was coming from the White Sox ranks pretty low on the shocked meter. You know, this is something that smart teams do is they find players on teams that don't do a good job with certain developmental aspects. And then they acquire them and it's just there's more meat on the bone there, right? There's more room to improve. And you see this on the amateur side too. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jordan, but like the University of Miami has like a bad reputation for developing pitchers. And so you see some smart teams drafting pitchers for Miami because the thought process is, well, they're getting talented players and then they're not getting great instruction. And so we can go and we can improve them, right? And I think that happened. The Brewers acquiring Nick Mears from the Rockies last year, there was a time where the Mariners were like trading for every Royals reliever under the sun and fixing them. And so this is kind of in line with that. And if I was a team that trusted my, hitting development, I would just go to teams that have bad hitting development. I would just take three or four of those guys and see if I could do it.
You could apply it to, I know this is weird because he had that weird brief stop in Boston on the way, but Quinn Priester. I mean, Quinn Priester, that's another guy that former first round pick. Quinn Priester.
Who?
First round pick who was not finding it in Pittsburgh, but boy, not, which is, again, it's like Pittsburgh has seemingly done well with pitching, but I guess his time kind of ran out there. And another 2019 first rounder, right? Quinn Priester. So Quinn there Priester. You go.
I'm buying. All right,
Jake. We're all in. You're all in on Andrew Vaughn. Brewers, there's like a million Brewers topics we could do, but keep winning and we'll keep talking about you. All right. We have a few other topics in this second chunk. Let's go around the league. Jake Mintz, let us begin with another player who we probably should be talking about a lot more, and that's Nathan Eovaldi. I don't know if we need to do a full Nasty Nate discussion right now, but we've gotten some emails about him, and I think after his most recent outing where he shut out the Yankees for eight innings and his ERA lowered to 1.38 over 111 innings, I think we're now kind of starting to take notice, like, wait a minute, hold on. I don't know. He's not going to get to 200 innings. He might not even qualify, but we're still one of the great run prevention seasons of all time.
So I think the reason he's gone under the radar is because he doesn't qualify yet. So if you go to, you know, any leaderboard, no, I'm just using Fangraphs, good website. There are 61 qualified starters, and the fewest innings on that list is Quinn Priester at 114 and a third, and Eovaldi's at 111. And so, like, in a couple of weeks, he'll be qualified. So, but when you go to any leaderboard, usually it's preset to qualified. And so when you sort by lowest ERA on qualified, you're like, oh yeah, like there's Paul Skenes with the 194. But if you just lower the minimum from 113 to 110, oh, there's Nate Eovaldi with a 1.38, dear friends. Now, his expected ERA is a 3.04, but his FIP is a 2.37. Like, he has legitimately been one of the best pitchers in the league. And if Tarek Skubal and Garrett Crochet didn't exist, I think this conversation would be a lot different.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm just so impressed by is that he basically misses all of June with an elbow injury. When he goes down, he has a 1.56, and you're like, well, that's amazing, but it's the end of May, and he's now has an elbow injury. Like, we don't know when he's going to come back. Like, this is just a small sample thing that we'll kind of put in our back pocket and forget about. And then since he's come back, in seven starts, he has a 1.08 ERA. So he's improved since he returned and has lowered it even further. So obviously the Rangers pitching has been one of the biggest stories for them all season, what him and DeGrom have been able to do, and Mally too before he got injured. But yeah, this is just one of the more remarkable seasons that is. Now, here's the problem. When your ERA is this low, the margins are so small that all it's going to take is one bad outing, and this will not be a story anymore. But as long as the ERA starts with a 1.5, this deserves more attention. And so I wanted to make sure we acknowledged it on this here baseball podcast. Let's stick with the pitching. Anything else on Eovaldi?
One last thing on this. Like, if you're trying to look at, like, what's sustainable, what's not, I'm very impressed by his batting average against and his ability to limit contact. Mm-hmm. Like, how good are the Rangers at defense? Like, is it a good defensive team? Yeah, they're a good defensive team, which certainly helps. But the only qualified starter with a lower batting average against is Tarek Skubal. Who, by the way, like, anytime you look, I know that the point of this segment is to just give Eovaldi some love. Man.
Good. I mean, Skubal's amazing. The Skubal peripherals are outrageous. The Paul Skenes run prevention, though, as Paul Skenes reached 5 WAR yesterday. I know Skubal's at 5.7, but hey, there's some good pitchers. Speaking of some good pitchers, this guy's not as good as these Cy Young contenders. Gavin Williams almost threw a no-hitter this week. Now, this is significant because, as I'm sure you maybe realized as you were preparing to write about this on my day off, Cleveland has not had a no-hitter in longer than any other team. So
really,
this would have been a huge deal. They have not had a no-hitter since Len Barker's perfect game in 1981.
Oh, I remember that.
And that was a great day.
Where were you?
For Len. Where was I?
Where were our parents?
Where were our parents in 1981? But this was a hell of a close call. But Gavin, after it was so funny, the swing of emotions, because he strikes out Francisco Lindor to lead off the ninth with just, I mean, when his curveball's on, I mean, this has been true since he was at, you know, East Carolina. Oh, man. I mean, that thing is gnarly. And that strikeout, you're like, well, I mean, just keep throwing that pitch. Like, what are we doing? I mean, especially that, when Lindor strikes out, his helmet falls off, and you're like, dude, just throw that 20 more, whatever, 10, 15 more times until you have a no-hitter. Yeah, just like, that's clearly the answer. And instead, he's like, let me try to throw a fastball past Juan Soto in his fourth at-bat
of
the game. Oh, not the best idea.
Turns into Williams. A Juan hitter.
Yeah, one hit for the New York Mets, a monster home run to center field by Juan Soto. Did that ease the pain of getting swept at home by Cleveland for the Mets? No. Not really, but you at least were not a part of history. As for Gavin Williams, I mean, this is really kind of what he looked like in 2023, right? Before last year injuries and just a disappointing showing amidst a messy season for the whole Guardians rotation. This is what it's supposed to look like, man. As a big, strong dude that throws really hard, that's got really good stuff. And when he's cooking and he's, and by the way, he walked a few guys in that game. Like that wasn't his sharpest outing of the season by any stretch, but when the stuff's that good, you can, and the offense you're facing is not doing so great. You're going to have some pretty impressive numbers by the end of the day.
You've been around in this year. What's his vibe? Like I just get the sense that he's got like huge country bumpkin energy, just like the way he moves on the mound. Like he's like wearing overalls in like Marky Dubois way, and that he just got scouted by like throwing rocks at a fence on a farm.
Kind of. It's not that far off. He is pretty Southern. And he's just a goofy guy, man. I mean, he is a real big goof. And that's why it is funny to watch him kind of get up there and just throw it past people, or at least people not named Juan Soto. But, you know, for the most part, he's again, like, this has been a weird season for the Cleveland pitching staff for a lot of reasons, but he has been a clear win. And I think someone to build around. I think that's what they've been hoping for him for a while. I know injuries have interrupted that, but you got to feel good. And by the way, man, I mean, Cleveland's they're in it. They're not out of it. They're right there. They're playing the White Sox this week. They got the Marlins next week. They still could use a little bit more. The offense is looking a little bit more competent. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes, but they are not irrelevant quite yet. No.
Do you think Gavin Williams maybe was, I mean, conspiracy theory, maybe he was betting on himself to not throw a no hitter and you know, and so in that situation, he had to give one up. That's why he threw the fastball.
Hey, you know,
open up your third eye.
You just got to ask questions, man. You just got to, you know, we got to investigate everything. No, okay. I don't want to.
So I know you didn't listen to the pod. Right. I know you didn't listen to the most recent pod, but we did a for your mentions for the Yankees. And one of the highlights / lowlights was fans being like, Williams and Boone are gambling against the team. Definitely investigate them. They made hundreds of millions of dollars gambling against the Yankees.
Yikes, folks. Yikes. All right. Actually two more quick topics. One is Josh Naylor can't stop stealing bases. This is one of the strangest things I have ever seen. Josh Naylor getting to 20 stolen bases before he gets to 20 home runs. I don't know what kind of odds you could have gotten on that before the season. But super bizarre. He was running in Arizona. He's running even more with Seattle. Unfortunately, he left Thursday's game with a shoulder injury, which is not great for a Mariners offense, which is really starting to click around Josh Naylor. This is absolutely wild. How about that fact from Mariners PR? Some of the best in the biz. First player with 10 stolen bases in his first 12 games with the franchise since Billy Hamilton. which hold on, did Chandler Simpson not do that earlier this season? That's kind of incredible that Chandler Simpson did that this year. I don't know. I mean, listen, stolen bases in this era fascinate me. With the rule changes, I generally just believe, like, go. Like, run. People. Like, it's easier than ever. Like, these catchers cannot stop you, especially when they're not expecting it. And it feels like Josh Naylor's really taking that to heart.
Divisional era since 1969. 2020 seasons by a first baseman. Now, Josh Naylor is currently at... how many home runs?
Homers,
he's got 14 homers.
Oh, only
Willie
14.
Hit
oh,
six
gosh.
Over the last month and change. I'll say yeah. I'll say yeah.
I mean, it's but weird because on one hand, it's like, yeah. Yeah, of course. On the other hand, it's like, well, he only has 14 now for some reason, and he's been playing every day, mostly in Arizona. So,
2020 seasons, first baseman. Palmeiro, Bagwell, Kevin Young. This is awesome. Bagwell again. Ryan Klesko, Derek Lee, Paul Goldschmidt twice. Will Myers twice. Ian Desmond, 2018 in Colorado somehow. And then Freddie Freeman in 2023 before he hurt his foot last year, was running a lot as well.
Oh, okay. But again, Josh Naylor, we've had some first basemen where it's like, yeah, you can run a little bit. Josh Naylor at no point has been in that bucket.
What do you think the record is?
A lovely wrinkle.
What do you think the record is steals by a first baseman in a season?
Is it Bagwell? Or it's honestly, my guess is it's someone like 130 years ago would be my best.
Yeah, I did since 1969, and Rod Carew in 1976 at 49. Recently, we'll do like, you know, wild card era.
Okay.
In the wild card era, it's Goldschmidt with 32 in 2016. That is within reach here for Naylor if he gets back on the field.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I'm obviously not happy to hear a shoulder injury, but I'm glad the lower half is still intact so that he can keep on
it's
scooting
just
over to second base.
Because, like, if I did a lineup of random baseball players for my wife who doesn't watch ball, and I said, which one of these guys steals bases? Josh Naylor would not be the first pick.
I mean, he stole like four last year. Like, I watched this guy for a whole season. This was not in the arsenal. So I don't know, man. I am enjoying this plot twist for the Josh Naylor season with the Mariners. Hopefully he is not injured. All right, one to more topic before we take a break. And that is some history, Jake. As Jen Powell is about to become the first woman to ever umpire a regular season Major League Baseball game. This will happen this weekend in Atlanta, where the Marlins and Braves are playing five games, not just four games. Mm. There was a rainout earlier this year, which meant that Saturday is now going to be a makeup doubleheader. Because there is a doubleheader, they call up an extra ump. And that is going to be Jen Powell, who has been umpiring in the minor leagues for almost 10 years now, has worked her way up to AAA. She has done a couple spring training games in the big leagues. And this is something that was on her radar last year because I believe she was on the call-up list last season. And now she will be a big league ump, which is pretty freaking sweet. It is, I think, the most simple way to point out about how big of a deal this is and how almost shocking this is in the context of baseball history. I know our friend Chelsea Janes had a good post about this that I saw, but we've had women umps and refs in football and basketball for a long time now. This is not a new thing. Like, I remember when this first happened in the NFL and the NBA, and you just look around and be like, well, wow, this is an extreme outlier, the degree to which this does not exist in baseball. And so that is why this is a big deal. And the reason why it's because not only is it, of course, history, but it's like, well, yeah, why couldn't we have women umpires? Like, there's no reason not to. And so this is, but it takes a lot. It takes a lot to overcome because, as we know, it is a ridiculously male dominated space that impacts our sport in many ways, mostly for worse. But this is a big deal.
Yeah, it's really simple, right? It's like we want baseball to have more different types of people involved and visible so that more different types of people are watching, enjoying, and feeling connected to the sport. And I think that is true when it comes to broadcasters. That is true when it comes to front office people, to coaches, big league staff. And that is true when it comes to umpires who are very visible. They are on the field. You see them all the time. Now, they're dressing in black so that you don't think about them. And the best version of an umpire is one you don't think about. And so for that reason, I kind of hope I don't have to think about Jen Powell for a while. Now, you and I like talking about umpires as characters, right? But the best version of an umpire, someone who adds a little flair to their calls, calls a good zone, diffuses arguments and doesn't make them the center of attention. And there's, you know, I'm excited to watch Jen Powell do that, you know, and yeah. I hope that she's yeah. not the last one. She certainly won't be. Let's take a quick break, Jordan Schusterman. And when we get back, we will reveal how you did in our Heart and Hustle trivia game and do the good, the bad, and the ugly. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. On our last episode, Jordan bailed on me. No, he was on vacation. So I had Foolish Baseball, Bailey Freeman, our good friend, come on and co-host. And we played a little game that Jordan and I play every year, the Heart and Hustle Award Guessing Game. If you did not listen to the last episode, that's fine, but you should. Here's the bit, okay? There is a very vague award that the MLB Players Alumni Association hands out called the Heart and Hustle Award. It is presented annually to an active player who, quote, demonstrates a passion for the game of baseball and best embodies the value, spirit, and traditions of the game. If that sounds kind of pointless, well, you get the bit. One player from all 30 teams is nominated as the winner for that team, and then one winner is chosen for the league. I had Bailey go through all the teams and guess who the nominees were. And Bailey Freeman, our friend, went 15 for 30. A very impressive showing. Now, Jordan, we're not going to go team by team with you. You sent me your picks, and I am going to let you know right now that you went 13 for 30, and you lose. Good day, sir.
Okay, before we get to the full reveal, because I'm so fascinated by some of these, and you know, you intro this and be like, oh, you know, kind of discarding the importance of this award. It's not that there's not value in this award. It's that it is just annually inscrutable. And so it's more of just like, okay, so someone who really likes baseball and like really shows it, but then also is probably pretty good, but then also is definitely not a pitcher because we know those pitchers can't hustle. So all of that is why we like doing this guessing game, is because it's just a tough thing to pin down. And I am usually better than 13 out of 30. But I will say, having sat down and attempted to guess, and I sent you my guesses, there were some tough ones here. I definitely got a little bit too cute with some of my guesses, and I'm sure that
you got
cost
way
me.
Too cute.
So you got yeah, way too so cute. For there's probably 3 to 5 where I was just I kind of threw them in the trash, and if I really focused and went with the obvious one, then I probably could have gotten 16 or 17. That said, I stand by some of my guesses, and I'm excited to see what I missed and which ones I nailed.
So the most impressive one that you had that Foolish missed was Jake Mangum as the Tampa Bay Rays award winner.
That was the one I in my bucket of, oh, this is too cute. But then I was also like, he is Heart and Hustle. He's exactly who Heart and Hustle is. So, oh man. Okay. So I am proud of that one, that I got that one right. But okay, then I'm sure some like Chase Meidroth. I know. He said, you know, Tyler Freeman, he probably didn't win. What were some of my biggest misses?
Your biggest misses, in my opinion, we're not going with Marcus Semien for the Rangers, who is just the shoe-in every year. You went with Josh Smith. A little too cute on that one. I would say you got a little cute for the Reds, going with Ellie De La Cruz and not TJ Friedl. TJ Friedl.
That's the opposite of
Foolish
cute.
Nailed
that's
that.
The problem. That was the opposite, of opposite cute. Of that cute. One was, because this is the other problem, sometimes you just default to the best player. And in that case, Friedl is perfect. So that's a miss for me.
I was surprised that both of you missed on the Phillies. You said Trey Turner. He said Bryson Stott. The answer was Kyle Schwarber.
No.
I know Kyle Schwarber doesn't have a lot of hustle, but he's got tons of heart.
That's true. He's got the heart covered for pretty comfortably. Oh my God. See, now I'm looking at the answers. Missing Zach McKinstry is also fairly, I think, unforgivable. So that is a huge L for me. And then missing Matt Olson, I got cute. I went with Nick Allen. That's also a whiff. Because especially like in the same with Semien, like you take the Iron Man, you take the guy that shows up and goes to work every day, right? And so that is a huge whiff on my part. Now, just to be clear, did we once again go 30 for 30 position players? It seems like we did.
30 for 30 position players, yes.
Okay. Okay. Wow, Andy Pahes. Nice. Good for that. Andy Pies is the way I'm seeing some of these guys. Okay, I nailed Sal Frelick. That makes me feel good. Brendan Donovan is like lock of locks every year. Hunter Goodman. That was one where I should have done just because it's like, he's their all-star. He's fine. He's a catcher.
The hardest here was the Cubs. You both got it wrong. The answer was Nico Horner, but Dansby Swanson and PCA are both completely legitimate ways to go.
Totally. The other one that I missed, and I really struggled, it's very validating. Machado, I struggled with the Padres because I know Machado at no point during his career has embodied hustle. I recognize that. but he also is in the Iron Man bucket. Like Luis Arraez, who won, like, Luis Arraez is awesome, but I don't feel like this year.
You want to know why he won?
The Luis Arraez season? Why?
He won because he's old school, because he makes contact and hits for high average. Yeah, and remember, he had that collision earlier in the year and it was really scary. And then he like was back in a week.
Okay. Yeah.
That's hard. Sure. That's hard.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I guess. All right. So, well, I'm proud of Jake.
Before we move
proud
on,
of Jake Mangum. Yeah, any other big takeaways? Yeah.
I'm just saying, before we move on, who you got? Who you got to win? I mean, one of these 30 names has to be the answer.
I was going
to
ask that. Right. They haven't announced the overall winner yet?
No.
So last year it was Bobby Witt Jr., correct?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. Can you win this twice? I don't know. I'd have to look like maybe Schwarber.
Yes, Craig Biggio won twice.
Okay. What about Kevin Biggio? Is he not hustling enough? I don't know. I mean, I think this feels like Cal Raleigh. I got to be honest. This feels like, hey, dude, you're not going to win MVP, so you can win heart and hustle. Yeah. But
okay.
I don't know.
I'll take
this. Feels like part of the
betting
Cal
odds
story.
On this.
What do you think? Well, we don't even know how. I know it's like the Players Association.
Yeah.
Alumni, but the exact voting process is still a little bit unclear. So
Jordan,
let's
do a quick speed draft here. Okay. You take Cal Raleigh, we're just gonna get three. You take Cal Raleigh first. Okay. All right. Yep. I'm gonna take Jose Ramirez. He was number one.
That's fine. I'll take Schwarber.
Okay, I'm gonna take Zach Neto.
Yeah, man, he's perfect for this, but I just don't think that he's high enough profile. Wow, Michael A. Taylor, good for you, man. That's great. Okay, my third pick will be, you know what? Give me Kyle Stowers.
Great.
give me Kyle
Stowers.
He
doesn't even know he's doing the Derby. Him not knowing he was doing the Derby during All-Star, that's heart, man. That's heart. And his hustle to get out there and be ready. My last pick is Nico Horner.
Okay. All right. I could see Jeremy Pena also kind of. I know he's injured right now, but all right. This was so much fun as always. I look forward to finding out who is the ultimate champion, and hats off, Foolish Bailey. Mm-hmm. He is, I mean, it's no secret that
he's done
better than us. So yeah, good for him. All right, Jake, it is time. Our favorite time of the week. Let's get to it. The good, the bad, the ugly.
I will begin with my good. What was good this week? This is a tweet from @BostonKMen. The Boston K-Men, Jordan, are the people who hold up the K's at the game, you know? And they tweeted, good news. We might have to repurpose our 20-year-old Nomar sign discovered deep in the archives for Roman. R-O-M-A-N and N-O-M-A-R. This is awesome. Nomar is named Nomar. There are no other Nomars, right? Like, that's not a name that people have.
No.
Nomar. There's it's the most first name baseball player ever. Even more than Babe, in my opinion. Nomar. There's one Nomar. It's Nomar Garciaparra. Now, the reason he was named Nomar is because his dad's name is Ramon and Nomar's Ramon backwards. So I'm not exactly shocked that you rearranged these very commonly used letters. I am a spelling bee guy. And so when I see five letters together, I'm like, what are other things I can spell? And Roman for Roman Anthony is one of these. And so this is just great. Like, this just fills me up.
Yeah, no, it's great work. And if Roman Anthony ever ends up in a public dispute with the franchise and gets traded, maybe Nomar Mazara will come back and play for the Red Sox.
Oh, sure.
And then you can.
I guess there was another Nomar.
Unfortunately, Nomar Mazara is only slugging .399 in the Mexican League this year, which,
yeah,
I mean, I think you could slug .400 in the Mexican League. So I'm kind of concerned there.
More like Nomar Mazara.
My good this week is Xander Bogaerts. This dude has taken a lot of heat. Understandably, he signed an absolutely outrageous contract. Good for him. God bless. You know, that is a rich man. $280 million, 11 years.
Build your escalators.
It was signed, it was like, whoa. I mean, as far as outrageous AJ Preller moments.
Number one.
It really might be number one, right? I mean, this was just like, oh, my gosh. He was okay. He was like pretty good in his first year. And then last year it was like, oh, my God, this is year two of 11. We're really going to do this. This year, again, start of the season, it was like, yikes, where is this going? This dude has been on fire for the last month and a half or so since June 19th, Xander Bogaerts. Fifth in baseball in WRC Plus behind Nick Kurtz, Kyle Stowers, Kyle Schwarber, George Springer. He's hitting .342, .401, .535 in that span. And good for him. Xander Bogaerts seems like an awesome dude who's very easy to root for. And him struggling under the weight of this gargantuan contract that was probably irresponsible to give him is not his fault. And The Padres are going to need him. Because this is still a lineup. I know they've got some reinforcements. Did you know the Padres are 29th in home runs? I learned that yesterday. So Xander Bogaerts only has 9 homers, but he's got 2 in his last 2 games. And maybe he's got a power surge in him. But it's nice to see him. I like Xander. And him, for how good he was in Boston and how steady he was, for him to get this much worse was concerning. And it's nice to see him playing well.
It's just good to know that it's still in there. Right, whether or not he's able to sustain it over the entire length of what is effectively a child's schooling, 11 years or 12th grade, you know, like that, is a question mark, but at least it's still there. My bad this week is also related to getting in base knocks. I went to Nationals Park for 4 days in a row. I did not stay for any of those baseball games. Okay, which has turned out to be a good thing. New DC resident Jake Mintz saw 0 of the 80 hits. The 80 hits that the Nats gave up over a 4-game span. 3 against the Brewers, 1 against the A's. They became, according to friend of the program, Spencer Nussbaum of the Washington Post, the first team since 1932 to give up 80 hits over a 4-game span. Who are they, Kelly Clarkson?
80
giving up all those hits, making all those hits.
Also, allowing that many hits in 1932, like, that was probably, well, I don't know. It depends, because obviously the defense was much worse. But man, 80 hits. Hits, remember, batting average, not a thing right now. We're not getting hits. Teams aren't getting hits. That's not how they're scoring runs. Drawn walks or hitting homers.
That's how the Brewers are scoring runs.
Right. Hits, man. Oh my God, 80 hits. And I know that you know, by the way, this was not in Coors Field. I know Toronto put up
a very normal ballpark
against the Rockies this week, but 80 hits at Nats Park is just troubling. So yeah, Nats are in a dark place. They had that walk off to not get swept, but man, oh man.
They did. I've been spoilt the last few years watching the Yankees and the Mets every day, and I like Yankees fans and Mets fans right now to be like, our teams are terrible, they stink. I'm like, brother, you don't, like, I didn't understand. I didn't understand. But like kind of locking into some of these games last few days on my television,
yeah.
3 miles from the yard, I was like, geez, this team stinks. This team stinks. The Mets and the Yankees are potentially, you know, they're underperforming and they have blunders. But my Lord, the Nats, just yuckety yuck. Hopefully it gets better so I don't have to move again.
Speaking of the Nats, one thing that they did well, I think, was the deadline. I think they did pretty well at the deadline. And that included trading Mike Soroka to the Cubs for two prospects. Mike
Soroka.
Mike. Christian Franklin, who is a athletic outfielder who'll probably be in the big leagues at some point in the next year. And Ronnie Cruz, a young shortstop who, you know, lottery ticket, but there's some things to like there. Mike Soroka went to the Cubs as the only starting pitcher that they acquired, and a starting pitcher who we were like, is he a starting pitcher? Are we sure about this? Remember, this is a guy who went to the Nats so that he could be a starter, but it wasn't really going super great. He had a 4.87 ERA at the time of the trade. His velocity had been going down over the previous month. The Cubs decide this is the only pitcher we're willing to really shell out for, and it's going to be Christian Franklin and Ronnie Cruz. You can't touch any of our top 20 prospects. Don't even think about it. Mike Soroka is already injured. He threw two innings. He allowed a home run. He left and is now on the IL with a shoulder issue. And for a Cubs team that not so long ago said, screw it, Astros, here's Cam Smith and Isak Paredes for a rental in Kyle Tucker, we're going for it. This deadline, days after Jed Hoyer got an extension, they decided, Willie Castro, Mike Soroka, Andrew Kittredge. Oh, immaculate inning. Watch out. Here we go. Taylor Rogers. It's not good. It's not good. The Cubs still have enough talent to win this division. But the optics here are obviously unfortunate. I do not wish ill will on Mike Soroka, and I'm sure he feels terrible. I'm sure he was looking forward to contributing more. I hope he does. I hope this is a brief scare. I hope he comes back, pitches great for the Cubs. But when it looked like a questionable bet and also only bet, right? The only like this is the guy we got. That's tough. That's a tough one to swallow.
Our former boss at MLB and one of our very good friends, Gemma Kaneko, I think taught us a lot over our time at MLB. She used to do a thing when we were, you know, young and stupid and living in New York at age 22, 21. She used to take us to museums. I don't know if you ever went, but she'd be like, we're going to go do art school. I'm going to take you to this museum and we're going to learn about design, or we're going to learn about like things I knew nothing about. Right. And one of her points that she always said to me was like, this, whether it's like an outfit or a piece or whatever, it has to be cohesive. It has to make sense together, right? And I think about that with the Cubs, that their actions in acquiring Tucker are just totally disparate from the way that they moved at this deadline. It's just incredibly bizarre, and none of it fits in any way. Speaking of bizarre, Ugla. Tonight, Max Scherzer will face Clayton Kershaw for presumably the final time. Question mark? World Series preview? The funny idea about this being a World Series preview is both Scherzer and Kershaw getting starts in a World Series between these two teams.
I mean, there are so many layers to that of like, what's more likely? The Blue Jays in the World Series, the Dodgers in the World Series. What's more likely? Scherzer still in the rotation at that point, or Kershaw still in the rotation at that point? Like, the number of things that would have to happen. That said, this is not, it is at least something we can think about. But to your point, in all likelihood, this will be the last time they face off.
This, I believe, is the fifth time they have ever squared off. Famously, they went toe-to-toe in 2008 when they were both rookies in a game between the Diamondbacks and the Dodgers. It was supposed to be Randy Johnson against Greg Maddux. Fans, they were probably feeling robbed. Instead, they got Scherzer versus Kershaw, two more future Hall of Famers. Over the years, they have faced one another a couple different times. They faced off in 2018 And in 2021, when Scherzer was a Washington National, they faced off in the playoffs in 2016. I believe Kershaw has the edge 2-1. I love that Kershaw didn't even last four innings the first time they faced each other. Just like couldn't shoulder the load. But it's just cool that, you know, this is a reason I'm going to turn this game on tonight. I'm excited to watch it. We got two starting pitchers going up against each other with narrative heft. We had this last weekend with Wheeler and Scooble, and this is a very different proposition for what these pitchers are now, their points in their careers. But I'm just, this is cool, man. It's, maybe it's not ugly. This is not really fill the spirit of UGLA, and for that I apologize.
I think like declaring it as the last, when like again like telling Scherzer in particular like, yeah, this is the last time you're doing something, like I don't want to tell him, we got to tell him that he probably thinks he's
so Max, this is the last again. Time you're gonna go up against Clayton Kershaw, says who,
like, what are you talking about, come on now. So yes, we will see. We will see if Blue Jays, I mean, also Blue Jays Dodgers is just, I mean, that's fun. So weird interleague, but fun. All right. My UGLA. Hey, Cubs fans, you mad about me dunking on you for Mike Soroka? Well, I'm about to give you some love. Jake Mintz, the Chicago Cubs are potentially going to make history this year. The Chicago Cubs have only grounded into 48 double plays all season long in 114 games. Are you aware that your Baltimore Orioles set this record last year?
Yep.
71 double plays all season, which was a new record low for a team in 162 games. And I'm not sure anybody noticed. I read a great piece on Slate from earlier this season from, I believe it was Jordan Ellenberg who wrote about this. And he was like, yeah, this is a record nobody noticed, nobody cared. But I know you had mentioned Junior Caminero's potential double play history as an UGLA earlier this season. His pace has slowed down. He's still way ahead of everybody else, but I'm not sure he's going to catch, I think, Jim Rice for the most double plays by an individual in a season. But the Cubs are doing the opposite. There you go. There is my UGLA. Every double play that the Cubs ground into this season, please let me know so I can keep an eye on it. There it is. That's UGLA.
The reason that they're doing that is interesting. They steal a lot of bases and they don't hit a lot of ground balls. And so that means that if a runner is on first base, they're often trying to go to second base where they're either thrown out or now standing on second base. And if the runner does remain on first base, the odds of them hitting a ground ball are lower than every other team except for the Tigers, who have the lowest ground ball rate in the game. All right, Jordan, weekend preview. We got some fun stuff ahead this weekend. Astros going to the Yankees. We got that 5-game Marlins Braves set. Which is like a great opportunity. Like, Marlins Braves won't probably matter in the end for the season, but this is just an opportunity for the Marlins to dunk on Atlanta's corpse. Like, this is, we are definitively better than you, the Braves. Well, if they take 4 out of 5 in Atlanta,
they already lost last night.
5-gamer. So
okay, they already lost last night. So now it's going to be a little bit harder. But no, I agree. I think, you know, how that game started last night before the Braves came back, it felt like we were trending that way. But 5 games. And if the Braves take all 5, I will have to come up with a term for this 5-game weird mop that happened. But otherwise, we've got Astros at Yankees. We've got Phillies at Rangers, Mets, Brewers, Red Sox at Padres, and Blue Jays at Dodgers. Those are the highlights for me of that group. I know we already mentioned Blue Jays, Dodgers. Anything else you are specifically looking forward to this weekend?
I'm looking forward to not working on Monday and Tuesday. I'm at the beach, and you will not hear from me. So guest host on Monday, Jordan?
Should we reveal?
Foolish Baseball? I'm kidding. No.
No.
We'll leave everybody hanging. It's exciting if you're a nerd. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
No, I'm very excited much. About this. This will be a Barbacast debut, and I'm excited about this one. So looking forward to that. Thank you, Jake. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and TJ Brassel for producing. As always, you can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. If the Cubs ground into a double play, please let me know as soon as possible. Until then, I will talk to you on Monday. Everyone have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.